American media is a business, and it has a mission. Not to inform Americans, but to entertain them.
You know, there's happy news for happy people with happy problems.
And the business leaders said that they had to renew with vigor what they called the everlasting battle for the minds of men and indoctrinate citizens with a capitalist story.
Global corporations feeding us the news as they see fit.
Truth is subversive. It's anti-American.
Americans have computers in school, dozens of TV stations, and the most aggressive news media on Earth. Does that mean they're better informed? Hardly.
And now, for Newsreel, here's Sean Kennedy.
It is a good day. This is Sean Kennedy reporting you from the Internet for Monday, December 22nd, 2008. And you are listening to Newsreel, the Wall Global Sit-Rat op on core political tyranny, technology, and trends for your headspace and timing. And that's a very good thing to keep track of in this day and age. More things have been invented in the last 50 years than in the history of the world. And how are you able to keep up when someone's committing suicide every 30 seconds inside of China because they can't keep up? And this show is here to make sure that you don't kill yourself. Rant Media is taking a stand for free speech today. And just by listening and distributing this program, you are too. You can follow up on all these news stories, and you can check my facts by going to my live journal, and you can get to my live journal by going to Sean, S-E-A-N underscore Kennedy .livejournal.com. This would be a free podcast that can be heard on Rant Radio, SRN1, Wild Bunch Radio, WNY Media Network, K-Drag Radio, Pure Rock Radio, Non-Surveyum Radio, Osprey Networks, Creek Radio, which bleeds into Radio Red Mercury, and let's not forget, when you're an archer, you're Leet for the Beast inside of Second Life. Yes, there's some background satanic messages for all the children out there, because if you go to Archer's node 155-74-666, and you will in fact be at the place where we do the show live every Thursday night, 7 in Second Life time, which is the same as Pacific time, which I think is 8 hours off of Zulu, but I'm not too sure. So, you know, but who the fuck uses Zulu time anyway? I mean, really. So let's get into some feedback right off the top. Dear Sean, just listening to the December 15th episode, where someone was trying to get the iTunes stream back. Yes, it's true. We did want to get the iTunes stream back. Why try to do it with Apple when you could just do it yourself? For those of us with the iTunes, go to the archive page, which you can find in the rantmedia.ca/newsreel/contact.php, and you copy the RSS address off of the Rant Media website, which I'll say it, feed:/br.st/tilde:clintman/cgi-bin/newsreel.cgi/podcast.xml kind of rolls off the tongue. Anyway, you plug that into your advance under advanced subscribe to podcasts, and it updates as if it was a subscription from the iTunes store and those good people who are taking away your buttons. Hope this helps to spread the good word, the fucking man to be. You no longer have to be, you just simply are. Thank you very much. That's the whole concept. Everybody is as good as they think they are, which I'm happy to see. I don't have a lot of people asking me for advice this week. I do a section of the show called Sort Yourself Out, and I honestly give a decent perspective which will save your life with any kind of problems that you're having. So if you would like to have my advice on your innermost personal problems in your life, don't ask me love life advice, because, you know, what do I know about love life? I'm married. Oh, that was cold. No, but seriously, I try to stay away from the drama bullshit stuff. Occasionally, though, I've gotten some crazy ones over the years. For those of us who go back to the archives, and I encourage you to do that, because there is some mild entertainment value in the hours and hours of Newsreel which exists. And some of the sort yourself outs I get are just like off the chain, like people challenging their sexuality, their gender, their species, for crying out loud. It's just crazy. It's crazy, I'll tell you. Speaking of species, you know, I was thinking about some stuff today. Our species. You know, it seems to me our species' greatest talent is to keep everybody who's within our species broke. Like, they want you to have nothing of value. Look at everything they try to sell us, right? What do you got? The iPhones, you got different brands of jeans. This pair of jeans costs $20. This pair of jeans costs, you know, $5,000. So they're both genes, right? They're both carbons. But they psychologically manipulate us so that, you know, they control our wants and desires. And you never notice the things that we want and desire for, quote-unquote, the bling, the spinning rims and all that kind of stuff? You ever notice that that stuff is utterly and completely worthless? Like, sometimes, I know, you know, not to get all completely wog out on you, but I'm thinking that what about, you know, if you're going to buy a device and you're thinking, wow, you know, this device is pretty groovy. It's a pretty groovy device, you know, and I'm going to buy it. What if the power goes out? Would that device still be cool? Would it be cool if the government fell? Would this be a cool device in, say, Somalia? You know what I mean? Sometimes you have to look at that kind of stuff because sometimes the stuff we buy, especially at this time of year, is crap, you know? And there's so much crap they force you to buy. That's why that Christmas is one of the highest times for suicide every year. That's why people are having such a hard time with this. And with you downloading this show on the 22nd of December, if I've done my math properly, I hope I have. It's not the 22nd, it's pretty darn close. But the 22nd of December this year is the shortest day of the year. Dark time, right? So you got to look at that and go, well, you know, what do you... what are you doing for the whole Christmas thing, right? You got a lot of dark weather going on. You got, ironically, they know that when you spend money, well, it's not really ironic, but they know that when you spend money, you feel better, right? So they're going to be trying to, isn't it a coincidence that perhaps they got everybody to spend money at Christmas at the dark time of the year by forcing you to try to feel better, yada, yada, yada. You know, it's a funny thing that sort of has happened over the years, and it's slowly become more and more manipulated, you know, over time. It's kind of unfortunate, really, and I don't really care for it much. But that said, you know, that I like Christmas. You know, I mean, I'm bad for the flip-flop, I know, but I like Christmas. Sure, why not? You know, the tree and everything, and the house smells nice, and blah, blah, blah. You know, peace on earth, goodwill, all that good stuff. You know, and notice when they say peace on earth and goodwill towards men, they're not usually like, you know, peace on earth and goodwill towards Christians. It's goodwill to everybody, okay? Like, can we just, like, not kill each other for, like, one day? Would that be cool? Because if we could not kill each other for one day, why don't we just not kill each other? Hey, that'd be cool. Because is there anything really worth killing each other over? Unfortunately, maybe there are. Sometimes people get attacked and it gets all political. But, you know, come on. It'd be good to at least try to, you know, have this kind of idea, you know, for lack of a better term, a concept. It's a good idea. But let's talk about things that are not good ideas. Let's talk about things that, you know, have no real... I guess they may not have a positive purpose. They might have a positive purpose. In mind rape news, a Japanese research team has revealed it had created a technology that could eventually display on a computer screen what people have on their minds, such as dreams. And I'm reminded of that film, Fortress, where in the future, you know, they're in a prison and they, like, scan people's brains and they look at their dreams. In the middle of the dream, the guy who plays Boddicker in RoboCop goes, "This is an unauthorized thought process," and then they essentially intestinate you, which is like a taser in your stomach that, like, totally rocks your bells, and it generally sucks. Anyway, I digress. Researchers at the ATR Computational Neuroscience Laboratory succeeded in processing and displaying images directly from the human brain. They said in a study unveiled ahead of publication in the U.S. magazine Neuron. While the team has now managed to reproduce only simple images from the brain, they said the technology could eventually be used to figure out dreams and other secrets inside people's minds. Figure out secrets inside your head, beta. It was the first time in the world it was possible to visualize what people see directly from brain activity, the private institute said in a statement. By applying this technology, it may become possible to record and replay subjective images that people perceive like dreams. Well, you know, we're a long way off from having this technology be a reality, but this is where we're going. When people look at an object, the eye's retina recognizes the images and converts it into electrical signals, which go into the brain's visual cortex. The team, led by chief researcher Yakuya Katamini, succeeded in catching the signals and reconstructing what people see. In their experiment, the researchers showed the people the six letters in the word neuron, and then succeeded in reconstructing the letters on a computer screen by measuring the brain activity. The team said it first figured out people's individual brain patterns by showing them some 400 different still images. Well, isn't that kind of something that's sort of frightening? I am thinking suddenly of the very first Batman movie that came out, and the Prince song, which went along with that film. There was one on the soundtrack, which is called Electric Chair. And one of the lyrics of that song is, "If a man is considered guilty for what goes on in his mind, give me the electric chair for all my future crimes." And it's true. It's totally true. If we're dealing with brain scanners that could show imagery in your brain, I've had dreams that I guarantee would put me on the medication wagon for the rest of my life. So kind of a frightening thing when you think about it. Where will this go? It's up to us. We have to make sure that we master this technology before it masters us. So all you kids out there, stay in school. And for those of us not in school, make sure you follow the news. Server will provide. Just be good to go. In booster news, speaking of booster news, scientists are developing new ways to selectively boost gene expression in the brain in hopes of treating psychiatric and neurological disease. A growing pool of evidence shows that compounds that target this mechanism can improve learning and memory in rodents. So, welcome to the secret of NIM. Boost gene expression in the brain for neurological disease, and then they're going to improve the memory of rodents. Mm-hmm. So, a little bit of German brain. You notice all the technology going into brain science these days? Little bit frightening. But existing drugs, which were not developed for this purpose, are relatively weak and unselective. Their long-term safety not yet clear. Well, there's a lot of drugs, but the long-term safety is not yet clear, but that's beside the point. Over the past few years, neuroscientists have begun to recognize the importance of epigenetics, molecule processes that change the expression of genes without altering their DNA, in the brain, in the memory in particular. One of the key regulators of epigenetics is a group of enzymes known as histone declasias, the histiosaurus, which triggers DNA to wind more tightly around neighboring proteins, ultimately dampening gene expression. This gene, you know, he's all over the place. And, you know, sometimes this time of the year, gene gets a little bit crazy. Recent studies have shown that existing drugs that inhibit these enzymes can enhance learning in both normal mice and those that are cognitively impaired. They can't work on the wog mice, though, because they're not having any of that crap. I think the implication for human disease is really exciting. Let me read that again. This is a quote. "I think the implication for human disease is really exciting," said Li Hui Tsai, neuroscientist at MIT. Last year, Tsai's group showed that giving brain-damaged mice an HDAC inhibitor allowed them to recall lost memories. What a Lovecraftian Disney story, eh? Oh, God, they give me the needle and I remember the pain. In Vivo Pharmaceuticals, a drug company based in Watertown, Massachusetts, is developing HDAC inhibitors that are more potent than existing ones and can easily enter the brain. Valporic acid, for example, a drug used to treat epilepsy and bipolar disorder, currently being tested for cancer, is a relatively weak inhibitor. Hang on! Okay, hang on. This drug, valproic acid, is a drug used to treat epilepsy and bipolar disorder. And it's being tested for cancer. Wow, this drug sure does a lot. You know, I guess epilepsy and bipolar must be really similar. Interesting. You know, I mean, that seems like just a weird thing to... Are you, like, making this stuff up as you go along, or is this drug actually designed for anything? According to results presented at the neuroscience conference last month, the company's lead HDAC inhibitor can enhance both short and long-term memory in mice. The company hopes to test the drug in the next year, says Michael Halijanian, Vice President of Research at Envivo. While scientists don't yet know exactly how epigenetic regulation affects memory, we don't really know. The theory is that certain triggers, such as exercise, visual stimulation, or drugs, unwind DNA, allowing expressions of genes involved in neuroplasticity. This that increases the gene expression, might trigger development of new neural connections, and in turn strengthen the neural circuits that underlie memory foundation. Pay attention, please. There's a test at the end. Maybe our brains are using these epigenetic mechanisms to allow us to learn and remember things, or to provide sufficient plasticity to allow us to learn and adapt, says John Stattery, Program Director of Epigenetics and the National Institute on the Drug Abuse, Bethesda, We have solid evidence that HDAC inhibitors massively promote growth of dendrites and increase synaptogenesis. Synaptogenesis? Wow. It's his time of the year. Hello, Synaptin' O'Jesus! We three wise men have brought you some milk, some cookies, and some HDAC inhibitors. The creation of new connections between neurons is Synaptin' Genesis. Very similar to Jesus, only just a bit, you know, further up in the book. Says Tesai, let me give that quote again without going off in some sort of biblical, you know, tirade. We have solid evidence that HDAC inhibitors massively promote growth of dendrites and increase synaptinogenesis, the creation of connections between neurons. Says Tsai. The process, that's T-S-A-I, not P-S-I, which would be super cool if that really was his name. The process may boost memory to allow mice to regain access to lost memories by rewiring or repairing damaged neural circuits. We believe the memory trace is still there, but the animal cannot retrieve it due to damaged neural circuits. Maybe if he uses a doubler, he could use, like, he could carry 120 gigs of data in his head. The safety of more important HDAC inhibitors, especially those that target the brain, is not yet clear. The paper published today in Neuron highlights potential problems. You know, what's funny here is that nothing seems to be really clear about this. We got this stuff here. We think that it enhances the memory. So, you know, the first thing we're going to do is try to use this as a weapon with the military. We're going to basically take some prisoners, feed them a whole bunch of this stuff so that their memories are, like, wide open, and then try to induce post-traumatic stress disorder in order to get them to tell us what they want us to know. That way we're not technically torturing them. Ta-da! I mean, you know, and I just had, you know, 5 minutes while I'm talking to you to think of evil things to do with this kind of technology. Mind you, could this be really, really good? Could this be, like, we're talking about a combination approach? You shoot up with this stuff, and then you just hardwire, because if they can read your brain, they can broadcast stuff into your brain. So is this like you combine those two and suddenly you've got, wow, I know Kung Fu? Is it cool? Yes, I think it's very cool. Is it possible? Maybe. Maybe. I think it would be cool if it was. I mean, if you could have one skill, that's one thing, isn't it? If you could have one skill, you know, that you were just like, ba-boom, you know, pretty hot with, you know, when you had to decide on it right now, what would be that skill? I think if I had to choose right now and suddenly I know more than anybody else, I'd probably say robotics. Just because I like robotics. I think robotics is pretty cool. Or maybe medicine. You know, I guess you want to think about medicine because that way, you know, you could help a lot of people, right? You know, like you could save the weak and the dying and stuff. Which reminds me, I don't think this made the actual news cut, but I should talk about a little bit, because the Georgia Guidestones apparently got vandalized, to, like, much to nobody's surprise. I'm sure that, you know, there's absolutely no one who is surprised the Georgia Guidestones have become vandalized, what with all the press that Alex Jones gives these guys and everything. I really can't say that I'm too surprised by that. But is that really going to strike fear in the heart of, you know, these crazies who are trying to take the planet? I don't know. But I don't know if you heard about that. It's interesting. I guess a bunch of people went up there and spray painted them, you know, thereby not actually destroying anything, just sort of making a mockery of it. I don't know. I think that some of the stuff on those Georgia Guidestones are pretty nuts. Now, speaking of pretty nuts, let's talk about some wet-weared bioweapons. Yeah! Lots of brain science going on here, and, you know, what would be better than wet-wiring animals? Of course, if we wet-wire animals, the PETA guys might get upset. But insects aren't really animals, are they? No, not really. So, insects could one day fly undercover missions for the U.S. military under the control of chemical-released microfluidic implants, U.S. researchers say. Now, this... Okay, if you think they're going to stop at moths, you know, come on. Give me a break. Scientists at Cornell University in Ithaca use microfluidics to manipulate metabolisms in moths, dictates when and for how long they could flap their wings. Combined with established electrical stimulation techniques, which influence flapping and flight direction, the method could eventually enable scientists to gain complete control over insect flight and perhaps create spying bugs. Like... stuff right out of the dark crystal, man. The team, led by David Erickson, the first to implant microfluidic chips into insects. The chips, each one as big as a moth's head, are filled with chemicals intended to paralyze the insect for short periods. Whilst older electrical techniques can be used to control wing motion, the new chemical method could work like an on-off switch for the insect. One of the most effective chemicals is the neurotransmitter gamma-amyobutyric acid, or GABA, a component of spider venom. The only problem is you have to grow mutant spiders, which are, like, you know, 30 feet long. No, okay, I'm making that up. The chip is then implanted into the thorax, or the belly of the insect, just before it transforms into an adult moth. Wow, sucks to be a moth in the Matrix. When the moth matures 2 days later, the team filled the chip with chemicals to 15% of the insect's body weight, applying the electric potential triggers the release of chemicals into the moth's body. The rapid immobilization GABA can immobilize the insect within a minute and prevent it from flying for 2 hours. According to the researchers, only one-third of the insects are able to fly following chip implantation procedure, fewer if the chip is implanted too early. But the vast majority survive the implantation process, and after injection, all regain complete control of the functions under a day. The insects... Wow! You know, imagine if they were doing this to primates. The insects, you know, the primates used in the study are a species of, Gabon apes. Okay, they're a species of tobacco hornworm moth with a 10-centimeter wingspan. That's a pretty big wingspan. And a flight range of kilometers, making them the perfect for reconnaissance and dangerous missions. Intriguingly, Erickson is unwilling to disclose further details of his research, which is supported by the U.S. Defense Agency, DARPA. DARPA and their crazy bugs. The research raises the idea of being able to use these insects to go to hazardous areas and check things out, says John Harrison, an insect flight specialist at the Arizona State University. These moths can be trained to detect all kinds of chemicals, so they'd be used to find explosives or fly out and land on buried landmines. Harrison thinks an integrated approach of using chemical and electrical techniques is needed for the idea to find real application. But as he points out, at present, the researchers only inject chemicals that shut insects down. It would actually be more useful to have chemicals that would promote flight rather than stop it. Just because an insect isn't immobilized doesn't mean it's going to fly, he says. Which is true. I mean, you know, what they should have is they should have some of the spider venom, and they should have, like, some Red Bull or something. You know, they have, like, the total crazy speed moth. And then your speed moth, you have, like, you know, you hit the one button that says, you know, go to sleep, and you jack them up with spider juice, and your cyber moth, you know, hits the floor. Or if you're flying along the cave structure and all of a sudden there's a Zomabudlan, you hit the rocket balls button and the moth's like, "Rocket balls!" And just flies through his head. Just bam! Blows his head right off. And he gets killed by a moth. An American ingenuity. That's right. Because sometime the war on terror, you've got to create cyborg insects in order to have the advantage on these crazy mud-hut people. Yeah. You know. What are you kidding? But let's not worry about that. If the cyborg insect thing, you know, never mind that. What if they take this technology and apply it not just to moths, but what if we put these on, like, you know, those baboon spiders, those crazy big ass spiders, or you know, the one size of a dinner plate, or those camel spiders out in the desert out there? And you got, like, you know, that's some biblical stuff, man. Now you want to strike fear into people? Don't bring over the Apaches. That's pretty cool and all. But, you know, if you got some guy in black robes wearing his cybernetic harm armor and he's got, like, a sea of sand spiders in the neighboring legions of billions blowing like a sandstorm behind him, and he just points out and these millions of spiders descend upon, you know, the encampment, and you watch people being stripped away like piranhas in the desert. I mean, you know, it could happen. You know, this is a cat. What if they can fall into the wrong hands? That's how you get stuff like After Now. And one of the things I thought up in After Now, now that we're on the subject, is Planamel. Now, Planamel is plastic enamel, which is designed to make synthetic bones. Now, in my stories, you can increase any bone size by up to 50% using standard Planamel. And quite often what guys would do, the spiders, people who live under the city, they would go and they would extend their bodies out and all this kind of stuff. I'm sure, you know, if you guys haven't checked out After Now, Tales from the After Now, Sean Kennedy, do a search. It's pretty cool stuff. Anyway, in Planamel news, in Sydney, artificial injectable bone that flows like toothpaste and hardens inside the body has been invented by a British scientist. This new regenerative medicine technology provided a scaffold for the formation of blood vessels and bone tissue, and can also deliver stem cells directly to the site of bone repair, says researchers. That's hot. Injectable bone is the first delivery system for stem cells and growth factors that form materials with the strength of a bone, said Rob Quirk, a pharmacist and co-founder of ReganTech, the University of Nottingham in England, a spin-off company commercializing the technology. Quirk says he hopes that injectable bone might one day reduce or eliminate the need for bone grafts to repair skeletal defects and fractures, which often require painful, invasive surgery. As well, we can use this to thicken up our existing bones so that we, in fact, become supermen and have cybernetic implants that we can have, like, Wolverine claws. And let's be real, is there anything really cooler than Wolverine claws? Not only does the technique reduce the need for dangerous surgery, it also avoids damaging neighboring areas and makes a hell of a concealed weapon. No, I'm kidding. Okay, said Kevin Shakechef, a tissue engineer and drug delivery pharmacist at Nottingham, who masterminded the breakthrough. The technology's superiority over existing alternatives is the novel hardening process and strength of the X project. Bond. Strength of the bond, said Quirk. Older products heat up as they harden, killing surrounding cells, whereas injectable bones hardens at body temperature without generating heat, making a very porous, biodegradable structure. Because the material does not heat up, surrounding bone cells can survive and grow. The invention emerged from a combination of research into implantable scaffolds that encourage new bone to grow and new techniques to deliver stem cells to drugs to specific sites. These studies spawned the new concept of an injectable matrix as the building block for tissue regeneration, said the researcher. So, you bust a bone, not to worry, we just hook you up to the toothpaste, you know, PL6000 glue gun here, and you're good to go. I mean, that's pretty hot when you think about it. Like, how could you use this to augment your body, especially for things like joints of knees and stuff like that? Like, could you get the infantry guys to, before they go to basic, you load them up with this junk so that, you know, they won't break their legs and spontaneous fractures and stuff? Just a thought. Quirk told Cosmos Online that the next generation of technologies based on this method will focus more on the therapeutic drugs and growth factors that can be delivered alongside injectable bone to stimulate tissue repair. Or if you inject it into normal bone, it'll be Hulk Smash. The idea of bone cement has been considered for some years, and similar compounds are being trialed in Australia. Because if anyone needs some bone glue, it's the Australians. Commented Bruce Foster, a good Australian name. An orthopedic surgeon and chairman of the Australian Bone Growth Foundation in Adelaide. Another new product capable of delivering stem cells is undergoing trials in Melbourne, which we're not talking about that. The British team behind the injectable bone won the Medical Futures Innovation Award last week and are now working towards clinical trials. They expect the product to be available in the U.S. within 18 months, provided the monkeys don't produce any, like, flipper babies or anything like that. But I guess that's all they're going to do for, you know, human trials is they're going to wait 18 months. I guess that's okay. You know, I suppose that's all right. I would probably want a little bit more research than that. But, hey, who gives a crap, right? You know. Now, in social network nightmare news. Now, if you wanted a reason to get off of Facebook, here's a good reason to get off of Facebook. I've been really seriously thinking about deactivating my Facebook account because, you know, I got it originally just so I could reach people with the show and stuff. And I'm kind of screwed anyway because anyone could find out anything they want to know about me. However, it seems that in a first, this was sent to me by RU46. Very, very cool. In social network news, Facebook has been used to serve legal documents in a case where defendants failed to turn up in court. Booyah! There's a reason not to have that account. In one of the first such cases in Australia, and possibly potentially the world, a Canberra court has used Facebook to serve legal documents in a case where defendants couldn't be found any other way. The Act Supreme Court ordered that a judgment be served to defendants via the social networking site after they failed to appear in court. Young Canberra lawyer Mark McCormack suggested a novel way to contact them. Both myself and my colleague Jason Oliver have Facebook accounts, so I thought we could have access, we could see if we could find them. The co-defendants were listed as being friends with one another, and their Facebook profiles displayed their birth dates, which is enough to satisfy the court the right people would receive the documents. The courts have previously allowed judgments to be delivered by email, and footballer Sonny Bill Williams was recently served via text message. A Victorian law firm says it has also used Facebook to deliver legal notices. The Victorian County Court delivered a six-figure amount against a defendant in a case after the Facebook communication was successfully sent through. The Victorian delivered a six-figure amount against the defendant in the case. Delivered a six-figure amount. Interesting. Lawyers say the willingness of the courts to use the new technology will give them more opportunities to perform their work in difficult circumstances. So, hey, you know, why not? Why not just text people? Why not, you know, not only do you get to pay for your tracking beacon that is your cell phone, you also get to pay for the convenience of having them be able to, you know, just serve you documents anytime. You can't say no, can't turn off the all-seeing eye. You might miss something. And God knows what'll happen if you miss something. You know, you might not be so terrified of what might happen next. Just a thought, you know, just a thought. But since we're already on that sort of thing, let's talk about some cell phone surveillance news, huh? Gotta be loving the segues. Segues are always fantastic. The FBI appears to have been using a novel form of electronic surveillance in criminal investigations, remotely activating a mobile phone's microphone and using it to eavesdrop on nearby conversations. The technique is called a roving bug and was approved by top U.S. Department of Justice officials for use against members of the New York organized crime family who are wary of conventional surveillance techniques such as tailing and suspecting and a suspect or wiretapping him. Nextel cell phones, owned by two alleged mobsters, John Ordito and his attorney, Peter Peluso, were used by the FBI to listen in on nearby conversations. The FBI views Ordito as one of the most powerful men in the Genovese family, a major part of the national mafia. The surveillance technique came to light in an opinion published this week by the U.S. District Judge Lewis Kaplan. He ruled that the roving bug was legal because federal wiretapping law is broad enough to permit eavesdropping even if conversations take place near a suspect's cell phone. Wow. Now, the funny thing here is that we've been saying this kind of stuff for a couple years here on Rant, but everybody sort of looks at you and goes, wow, Sean, you're just crazy. That's not really true. Oh, yeah? Kaplan's opinion said the eavesdropping technique functioned whether the phone was powered on or off. So it doesn't matter if the phone's on or off, they can still listen in. Some handsets can't fully be powered down without removing the battery, for instance. Some Nokia models will wake up when turned off if an alarm is set. Well, Genovese crime family's prosecution appears to be the first time remote eavesdropping mechanism has been used in a criminal case. The techniques has been discussed in security circles for years and years and years and years. The U.S. Commerce Department security official warns a cellular telephone can be turned into a microphone and a transmitter for the purpose of listening in a conversation in the vicinity of the phone. An article in the Financial Times last year said mobile phone providers can remotely install a piece of software onto any handset without the owner's knowledge, which will activate the microphone even when the owner is not making a call. Nextel and Samsung handsets and the Motorola Razr are especially vulnerable to the software downloads that activate their microphones, says James Atkinson, a counter-surveillance consultant who has worked closely with government agencies. They can remotely access and mainly transmit room audio at all times. You can do this without having a physical access to the phone because modern handsets are miniature computers. Downloading software could modify the usual interface that always displays when a call is in progress. The spyware could then place a call to the FBI and activate the microphone, all without the owner knowing it happened. The FBI declined to comment on this on Friday. Sounds pretty logical to me, though. Sounds like it's not too far out of the bag. If a phone has, in fact, been modified to act as a bug, the only way to counteract it is to have the bug sweeper follow you around 24/7, which is not practical, or peel the battery off the phone. Atkinson said, security-conscious corporate executives routinely remove the batteries from their cell phones, he added. The FBI's Joint Organized Crime Task Force, which includes members of the New York Police Department, had little luck with conventional surveillance of the Genovese family. They did have a confidential source who reported that the suspects met at restaurants, including Brunello, Trattoria, New Rochelle, New York, at which the FBI then bugged. But in July 2003, Ardito and his crew discovered bugs in three restaurants, and the FBI quickly removed the rest. Conversations recounted the FBI affidavits shows the men were highly suspicious of being tailed by police and avoided conversations on cell phones whenever possible. So, you know, when you're dealing with this kind of stuff, though, I mean, when you're looking at this, Should we all be totally terrified then? Should we completely remove our Facebook accounts? Well, you know, there is the argument that if you make a big deal with encryption, that you're kind of flagging yourself for people to see what you're up to. I mean, if you make a big deal about hiding stuff, then obviously they're going to wonder what the hell you're going, what you're doing. So the better idea, of course, is to blend in, you know, to make it look like there is nothing really happening. Just stay under the radar. That's the idea. Because, you know, if you start getting really, really over the top, I mean, you know, if we have an end of a society, that's one thing, and we should look probably pretty crazy. But a real strength of a WOG would be how easily they can adapt to a situation. Because if you cannot adapt, you will die. Take a lesson from the dinosaurs. They have a lot to teach, you know. Never forget. Now, in regaining rights news, this is from Big Brother Lord. Very cool. A federal appeals court today upheld, in part, a decision striking down provisions of the Patriot Act that prevent National Security Letter NSL recipients from speaking out about secret record demands. Okay. The decision comes as an American Civil Liberties Union and New York Civil Liberties Union lawsuit challenging the FBI's authority to use NSLs to demand sensitive and private customer records from internet service providers and then forbid them from discussing their requests. Siding with the ACLU is the U.S. Court of Appeals. The Second Circuit's court found that the statute's gag provision violated the First Amendment. We are gratified that appeals court found the FBI cannot silence people with complete regard for the First Amendment simply by saying the words national security, said Melissa Goodman, staff attorney with the ACLU National Security Project. This is a major victory for the rule of law, and the court recognized the need for judicial oversight over the government's dangerous gag power and rejected the Bush administration's position that the courts should just rubber stamp these gag orders. By upholding the critical check of judicial review, the FBI can no longer use this incredible power to hide abuse of its intrusive Patriot Act surveillance powers and silence critics. The appeals court invalidated parts of the statute that wrongly placed the burden on NSL recipients to initiate judicial review of gag orders, holding the government has the burden to go to court to justify silencing NSL recipients. The appeals court also invalidated parts of the statute that narrowly limited judicial review of the gag orders, provisions that required the courts to treat the government's claims about the need for secrecy as conclusive, and required the courts to defer entirely to the executive branch. The appellate panel correctly observed that the imposition of such a conclusive presumption ignored the well-settled First Amendment standards and deprived the judiciary of its important function as a protector of fundamental rights, said Arthur Eisenberg, legal director of the New York Civil Liberties Union. You know, I gotta say, I'm a big fan of the whole plain speech thing. You ever hear tell of these guys? The plain speech guys? They're the guys who think that, you know, not everything should be just like a 2 tons of legal mumbo-jumbo. They think that there's a good thing, like you can communicate without, you know, using this incredibly nutty word construct that everybody's, you know, where they come up with the legalese, you know? It's an interesting concept. You should look it up. In this regard, the story goes on to say, the opinion stated, the fiat of governmental official through senior rank and doubtless honorable in his execution of official duties cannot displace the judicial obligation to enforce the constitutional requirements. The court, therefore, also ruled that the government must now justify the gag on the John Doe NSL recipient in the case, a gag that has been in place for more than 4 years. The ACLU and New York Civil Liberties Union filed this lawsuit in April of 2004 on behalf of an internet service provider that has received an NSL. Because the FBI imposed a gag order on the ISP, the lawsuit was filed under a seal, and even today the ACLU is prohibited from disclosing its client's identity. The FBI continues to maintain a gag order, even though the underlying investigation is more than 4 years old and may well have ended, and even though the FBI abandoned its demand for records from the ISP over a year and a half ago. In September 2004, so obviously what's going on here is that they're making a statement. They're going to use this as a means to make sure that, you know, they can get rid of this law, which is good for them. I mean, you know what? Sometimes you got to have somebody who gets a little bit fair. The FBI continues to maintain the gag, even though the underlying investigation is more than 4 years old. So, you know, I would also wonder what's the why the big secret, you know, like, you all kind of work for us, let's just be honest. In September 2004, Judge Victor Marrero of the U.S. District Court for the Southern District of New York struck down the NSL statute, ruling the FBI could not constitutionally demand sensitive records without judicial review, and that permanent gag orders violated the First Amendment guarantee of free speech. Remember that? Yeah. The government appealed the ruling, but Congress amended the NSL provision before the court issued a decision. The ACLU brought a new challenge to the amended provision. In September of 2007, Judge Marrero again found the statute unconstitutional. Bills aimed at bringing the NSL authority back in line with the Constitution were introduced both last year in the House and the Senate after reports had confirmed and detailed the widespread abuse of authority by federal law enforcement. Since the Patriot Act was passed in 2001, relaxing restrictions on the FBI's use of power. Which is true, you know, there's a lot of crazy stuff that has happened since, you know, everyone just kind of lost their mind and started attacking everything under the rule of terrorism. There are terrorists out there. There are bad guys that need to get stopped. Don't get me wrong. But I don't think you're going to find them, in the movie theaters. I'm just saying. Anyway, the number of NSLs issued has seen an astronomical increase to nearly 200,000 between 2003 and 2006. A March 2008 Office of Inspector General, OIG, report revealed that, among other abuses, the FBI misused NSLs to sidestep the authority of foreign intelligence surveillance courts, and in one instance, the FBI issued NSLs to obtain information after the FISC twice refused its requests on First Amendment grounds. The OIG also found the FBI continues to impose gag orders on about 97% of NSL recipients, and that in some cases the FBI failed to sufficiently justify why the gag orders were imposed in the first place. In addition to this case, the ACLU has challenged the British... Pardon me. In addition to this case, the ACLU has challenged this British Act statute multiple times. And in one case, it brought was brought on behalf of a group of Connecticut librarians. I say that again, Connecticut librarians. And another case called the Internet Archive versus Mukasey involved an NSL served on a digital library in California. But I think it's pretty cool that a bunch of Connecticut librarians, took on these guys. Because, you got to like the whole librarian thing. In a later case, the FBI withdrew the NSL and the gag as part of a settlement of a legal challenge brought by the ACLU and the Electronics Frontier Foundation. Now, there's an organization that if you haven't donated to, you really should give a couple books. Or a couple of bucks. Still on the librarian thing. You should really give a couple of bucks to the good people over there at the EFF. They're a good bunch of guys. Now, you were waiting for the first time it would happen. Maybe it's happened in other countries, but it's a sad day today. Because where are all the terrorists? Where are they hiding? Of course, they're in the movie theaters filming movies. Canada has its first conviction under the controversial Bill C-59. A man has been found guilty of camming a movie, Sweeney Todd, in Calgary on its opening day. The 21-year-old was given a fine of $1,495 and placed on probation for a year. No cameras for you. During the time, he is also excluded from all theaters and is forbidden to possess any video recording equipment, even that on a cell phone. Okay? Unregulated media is pornography. He avoids jail. In early 2007, 20th Century Fox announced that Canada had a major movie camming problem, claiming that 50% of all such copies of movies originated from Canada. The controversial claims caused panic, and before long, theater staff were commonly being equipped with night vision goggles in a bid to catch pirates. Yarr! In December 21st, 2007, Richard Craig Laceman of Calgary hid a camcorder in his clothing and went to Empire Studios 16 Theater. There, the 20-year-old joined the matinee performance of the Johnny Depp movie Sweeney Todd on its opening day. Sitting in the left of the theater, to the left of the theater at the back, Leisman hid the camera in a sock and hid the telltale LED lights on his camera with duct tape to avoid being spotted. Wow, this kid's really advanced. Unknown to Leisman, an investigation financed by the Canadian and U.S. movie ticket industries had been underway for months. And his luck was about to run out. According to the Crown Prosecutor, Rob Bassett, the house lights were turned on, the movie was shut up, and the Calgary police arrested him. The accused later admitted he had recorded the picture. Charged with one count of unauthorized recording of a movie, Leisman became the second person in Canada to be charged under new legislation designed to crack down on camcorder pirates. Yarr. Previously, under Canada's laws, the authorities had to prove that any camcorder movie recording was destined for sale, rental, or other distribution to get a conviction. But now, with changes that took effect as of June 1st, 2007, any image recorded without the consent could result in a prison sentence of up to 2 years. You take a picture of it, you don't have permission to take pictures of it, you're going to jail for 2 fucking years. Yesterday, Leisman, now 21, pleaded guilty as charged and was sentenced by Judge Catherine Skeen to a $1,495 fine and a 12-month probation. During this period, Leisman is excluded from going into any movie theaters, is banned from owning or possessing any video recording equipment, including video-enabled cell phones. Good luck with that. Can you even find one? Virginia Jones, a director of policy and legal affairs for the Canadian Motion Pictures Distributors Association, said, We would have liked to have seen jail time to send a stronger message. We hope this is just a starting point. Yeah. Because, you know, does that guy clearly is a threat to society? You know, really? To go and you know, obviously, he's camming a movie? Oh, my God. Like, why is he allowed to live? You know, why don't we just take him outside and throw him in the caning machine? Which, did you know? I didn't know this. I had a person talk to me who lived in Singapore. And apparently, in Singapore, they cane people, right? The process of caning, what I thought it was, I mean, what's caning, right? They take some guy, they tie him up, they take a big cane, and some dude with a cane, you know, beats the living shit out of you. It's really brutal, actually. It beats the snot right out of you. But see, the Singapore people, they figured out that, hey, you know what? This isn't very good. So I figured digital caning, that's what I call a taser, right? No. The Singapore guys, they got it all sorted out. What they do is they have actually a caning machine. Because, you see, if you let a person cane another person, they don't do it consistently. Like, near the end of the caning, if they get, say, 20 hits, around 17, 18, the guy's feeling kind of bad. You know, he's feeling bad for this poor bastard he's been smacking the shit out of, right? So they built a caning machine. Now, I've never seen a picture of a caning machine. But, like, could you imagine? Like, wow, there's an album cover right there. A picture of a Singapore caning machine. Wow. Pretty nutty stuff. But, you know, to avoid the digital caning machine, it's always good to have your information with you at all times. Now, this is something that I've been thinking about doing. Computers are so cheap now that you can pick up one of these little notebook units for, like, next to nothing. But there's a maybe even cheaper way than that. Today's daily hack is with has to do with portable operating systems on USB drives. With an 8-gig flash drives being available for under $20 and a 32-gig drives edging their way into the mainstream, no one can blame you for shelving old USB sticks. But there are a surprising number of uses for these rickety old sub-gigabyte keychains. There are nearly endless ways to bring back USB sticks out of retirement. There are not just gimmicks. Virtually all USB sticks, 32 megs, 1.1 dinosaurs included, can be repurposed to anything from a life-saving troubleshooting tool to an entire portable OS. Now, the portable OS is something which is a very, very cool thing. Okay, I do dig the portable OS, and I think it's a really good idea to have a portable OS on a USB stick, because that way it's virtually untrackable. You see what I'm saying? It's pretty slick. So, according to the article here, it goes on to say that this is installing a portable OS is actually simpler and less esoteric than it sounds. Installing a wide array of Linux systems is pretty easy nowadays, and will more importantly net you a fully functional desktop that you can take with you wherever you go. Lifehacker recently assembled a useful comparison of popular USB-able Linux distributions, which they recommend in the fantastic un-netbootin, or creating a bootable keys in the first place. It is not worth having two of these distros. It is worth noting that two of these distros will work on keys less than 120 megs in size, and being as DSL is just some 50 megs in total, and carry it legitimately for a useful range of apps. Very, very cool stuff. So, you know, hey, USBs are neat. I don't care what anybody says. And that's all I got for you today, but don't worry, I'll be back next week to make sure you get the news you need to survive. It's been a free podcast brought to you by the Wogs Who Care. If you cannot donate to this program, if you can donate, do so. But if you can't, distribute it. Give it away to people. Give it to people you think might enjoy the show. Hey, you know what? It'll keep you awake if you're doing a long road move. And if you can donate, please subscribe. Don't go giving me a big bunch of money. If you're enjoying the show and you think four shows a month are worth a beer, give a subscription for $5 a month, if you please. And then gradually, over time, we'll build up our monies that we take in from the internet superhighway and put them towards building a massively psychotically huge compound, which we'll staff from people that we meet on the internet, and slowly but surely, we will build our empire from the ground up, and no one will be able to stop us. Oh, they'll call us mad. Oh, yes, but they won't take us seriously. And then before it gets too far down the pipe, it'll be too late, and they won't be able to stop us. Wha-bam! And with a triumphant cry of rock and balls, you know. But, you know, before that happens, if you want to send me a big wad of cash, send it to Rant Media Studios, Box 18121, 1215C, 56th Street, Delta, BC, Canada, B4M2M4. And I want to thank the Army Flying Monkeys for their assistance in gathering data. If you have information that you would like to send me, you can reach me at newsreel@renradio.com. If you like the music in the background, check out Psytrance. But I'm going to fade out now with something that is made of wind and dipped in awesome. You know what's awesome? It's RoboCop in 10 minutes in a wrap by Rico. And this was sent to me by the Boon, and this is art, man. I'm loving this. Remember, everyone, we will never defeat the enemy if we are at each other's throats. So until next time, that's what Surfer said. End of line.
Detroit is a city in urban decay. Alex Murphy is a cop and it's his first day.
Murphy transferring in from Metro South.
Sergeant Reed explains it could be bad for his health. Once Murphy's been given the guy to the station, a suspect breaks out in a violent situation. Murph's the part that deals with it, she's anything but girly. She beats the man up and says,
glad to know you, Murphy.
Catching Clarence Porter because they're all home with gold. They grab a police car and go out on patrol. Now the police is run by the OCB. There's a meeting with the heads of the company.
Old Detroit has a cancer is crime.
Dick Jones has the answer.
Head 209.
The robot stomps in, everyone stumbles back in fear. Dick gives a guy a gun and gets him to volunteer.
You have 20 seconds to comply.
The robot malfunctions and they don't know why. He's got Kenny in his sights, guns locked on his course.
I am authorized to use physical force.
Murphy spins a handgun on the bonnet of his car. He gets a call at random about Clarence Body Car. After robbing a bank, Clarence and his gang box up the cash and then they're off in a van. The money's all scorched. Clarence doesn't think it's funny. He yells out,
you found the fucking money!
Emil, the driver, spots a cop on their tail. They grab the shotguns. It's that or go to jail. They kick open the doors and fire at the wrong time because Lewis ain't stupid. She's driven alongside. During the shootout, Bobby's shot in the knee.
Can you fly, Bobby?
He gets thrown through a windscreen. The criminals escape now. That is until the police track them down to an abandoned steel mill. Backups unavailable, they radio to find out. So they split up and head into the gang's hideout. Lewis finds the first one pissing off a ledge. He distracts her with his cock and then punches her off the edge. Murphy finds the other two watching TV. He says,
better alive, you're coming with me.
But then he gets surrounded, they rough him up a lot.
Cops don't like me, so I don't like cops.
When he's reached a bloody stump, Murphy tries to stand. He turns to face the gang. They all up on fire, now Murphy screams in pain. Clarence takes aim and it blows out his brain. Lewis arrives in the nick of time to get him to the hospital before he flatlines. As the doctors try and save him from this savage attack, he has a flashback and everything turns black.
Can you do that, Dad?
I really have to tell you something.
When he awakes, he's part man, part machine, with scientists stood round his video screen. As they try and fix him up, he malfunctions a bit. He was tough before, but now he's even tougher.
You're gonna be a bad motherfucker.
After many more weeks, old Robo's complete. They unveil him from beneath a plastic sheet. They cheer and they clap after the presentation and take him back down to the local police station. Sergeant Reed didn't know and he's pretty pissed off.
Official OCP business, so please get lost.
He's told to sit in a chair which is constantly manned. Old Robo says,
yes, I understand.
His prime directives make him effective and diligent.
Serve the public trust, protect the innocent, uphold the law.
But there's one more, a secret in his pool called Directive 4. Can hold its excitement no matter how hard he tries.
I fucking love that guy!
Down in the basement of the shooting range, the police are shocked when they hear something strange. Most of them stop and some of them run.
It's Supercop!
That fucking gun!
This guy's really good.
He's shooting supreme,
but he's not a guy. He's a machine.
Finally, Robo gets a car before he's deployed.
Thank you.
Go get him, boy.
So give me your money and
all of it. Don't fuck with me!
Drop the gun, you are under arrest.
Stopping this scum is Robo's first test. He hits him across the room and he's even polite.
Thank you for your cooperation. Good night.
The next quest he must address is to stop two pests to more or less molest the girl and cause her distress.
Let the woman go, you are under arrest.
But the rapist won't listen, so he shoots in her dress. Clutching at his bleeding groin, he falls in a heap. Robo says,
your move, creep.
Later that week, Robo was sat in his chair, fast asleep until he has a nightmare. He's thrashing around while he's having his dream, and his dream could be seen on the monitor screen. As he dreams of being killed, he continues to shake, then the scientists run in and he suddenly wakes. He storms out to look for Clarence and his crew, but he bumps into Lewis.
Murphy, it's you.
Emil on his bike pulls up at the petrol station, proceeds to rob the place with excessive aggravation. He's got his finger on the trigger and he's about to pull it.
I bet you think you're pretty smart, huh? Think you're down smarter, both
drop it.
Says Robo as he arrives on the scene.
Dead or alive, you are coming with me.
Yeah, go!
killed you!
He escapes on his bike, using a cigarette to set the petrol alight. The gas station explodes, Neil doesn't get far. His robot shoots his bike, he crashes into a car. He goes back to the station with the information he scans, to access the database via a spike in his hand. He was murdered by Clarence, what Lewis said was true.
Honey, it's you.
I love to be intelligent.
And you need lots of stimulation, Bobby.
Must be the champagne.
The man at the door has a trick up his sleeve. He points a gun at Bob and says,
"Bitches leave."
With a silencer on, he shoots the legs and the knees of a terrified Bob, what he begs and pleads. Clarence whips out a DVD and Dick Jones' face fills the TV screen. He puts a grenade on the table to finish the job.
I'm cashing you out.
The house is blown up spectacularly. Then Clarence heads off to a cocaine factory. He says,
"I don't want to fuck with you, Sam."
Followed by,
"Guns,
the door's punched in and turned into rubble.
Come quietly or there will be trouble.
He targets all the criminals, of which there's quite a few.
Fuck you.
Robot comes in a barrage of lead and shoots them one by one until they're all dead. Now Boudica's gang are either killed or maimed, until finally only Clarence remains. He tries to escape, Robo grabs him though, and repeatedly throws him through the nearest window. His face gets cut up after each throw.
I work for Dick Jones! Dick Jones!
Robo tries to choke him but decides to stop.
You're a cop!
I am a cop.
Now Clarence has lost out, Robo's the winner.
Book him.
What's the charge?
He's a cop killer.
He spits blood on a desk, disgusting and all.
Just give me my fucking phone call.
Robo then goes off to arrest the vice president, using Clarence's confession as evidence.
You are under arrest.
You better take me in.
I will.
What's the matter, officer? It's a little insurance policy called Directive 4.
I had to kill Bob Morton because he made a mistake. Now it's time to erase that mistake.
Paralyzed and shutting down, Robo's fading fast. Head to a nine stops in to kick his ass. Now he's authorized to use physical force. He blasts him across the floor and uppercuts him through the door. Bombarding the rocket before the robot ignites. So he beats a retreat down the fire escape. 209's right behind him, he tries to give chase. But he slips on a step, falls down the staircase. Robo runs outside but is blinded by a beam. Dick Jones is called in an elite SWAT team. They fire on the cyborg, shooting round after round. The frost in the blast knocks him down on the ground. It looks like he's done for, but it's a relief. He rolls off the edge to the ledge underneath. Lewis turns up and helps Robo escape, while a SWAT team fires a hail of bullets in their way. Dick Jones meets Clarence the very next day. They both decide that Robo's gonna pay. Dick Jones is annoyed and starts giving him stick.
Take a look at my face, Dick.
To make sure Clarence doesn't mess up twice, Dick Jones gives him a tracking device. Before he leaves, he wants some heavy artillery. Dick says,
"We practically are the military."
The gang plan to meet somewhere quiet, but in the street that they meet, there's a full-blown riot. Emil can't hear the TV for the shouts and the hollers.
I'll buy that for a dollar!
Clarence turns up with a gun and they all get excited. Emil says,
"I like it!"
They blow up the car and then they blow up the shop. And then they're off looking for RoboCop. They track him down to a mill where Murphy was killed. As Robo takes his visor off with the drill, he hears a gang approaching in the van below. He says,
"Looking for me?"
For shooting Joe. Robo's outpaced as the van gives chase. But in his haste, he drives into toxic waste. Acidic liquid flows all over the place, melting the clothes and the skin off his body and face. Clarence races towards him, but his advance is slowed as low as his police car rams him up the road. Clarence is preoccupied and doesn't see Emil, who stumbles in front of his automobile. The body explodes, covers the windscreen with blood. He crashes the car upside down in the mud. He bursts out the car, firing like crazy. Shoots Lewis down the hill, says,
"Bye-bye, baby."
Robo arrives now to settle the score.
"I give up.
I'm not arresting you anymore."
This is the end, he's got himself to blame. But Leon appears overhead in a crane. Clarence pleads with the cyborg, he can't let him go though. Then Leon drops a ton of girders on Robo. They both cheer, then their celebration ceases when Lewis with a gun blows Leon to pieces. Clarence grabs a steel pole with Robo helpless. He hits him as hard as he can, stabs him through the chest. Until Robo's dead, the villain just won't stop.
I adore a RoboCop.
But now comes a twist, something Clarence has missed. When he's stabbed in the throat with a spike in his fist, he falls in the water, blood spraying and jets. Lois looks up.
"I'm a mess.
I'll fix you,"
Robo says to his friend.
"I fix everything."
Now he's got his revenge. He pulls himself free. A confrontation is due. He makes his way back to OCP HQ.
"You're illegally parked on private property."
He enters the boardroom before going any further.
"Dick Jones is wanted for murder.
serious charges. What is your evidence?
Robo goes to the TV with no hesitance.
I had to kill Bob Morton because he made a mistake. Now it's time to erase that mistake.
Dick grabs a gun and holds the old man hostage. But with Directive 4, Robo can't accost him. He asks for a chopper so he can't be arrested.
Anybody tries to stop me?
You old geezer gets it.
He's about to be prematurely retired. The old man says...
Dick? Thank you.
Directive 4 vanquished, Dick takes his last breath as Robo blasts him through the window to his death.
Nice shooting, son. What's your name?
The old man asks curtly. The part man, part machine replies.
Perfect.